Good morning. This is AM 580 WILL and Focus 580, our telephone talk program each morning. I'm Tom Rogers, filling in for David Inge. David is a bit under the weather today, so we will have fill-in guests, fill-in hosts, but the same guests, let's put it that way. I'll be in the 10 o'clock hour, and coming up at 11 o'clock, Jay Pierce will be talking with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. In this hour, though, our guest is David Desser, who's a professor of cinema studies at the U of I, and we figured we'd bring him in at this time of year because aside from summer, Christmas, the Christmas season is the big time for the Hollywood movie studios to trot out their pictures, and especially some pictures that will be under consideration for the Oscar Awards next spring. We'll talk about some of those pictures, some of the more blockbuster type of movies as well, and other things about the movie industry itself with David Desser. And your calls, as always, are welcome. Our telephone numbers are 333-9455 inside Champaign-Urbana in the local calling area. And outside, our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL or 1-800-222-WILL. Tell us about David's opinions are on, ask his opinion on some of the movies that are coming out or what you may have seen. We want to hear some of your opinions of what some of the current movies are bringing to the table as we head into this busy season, the second busy season of the year. Good morning, David.
Hi, nice to be back.
And you've seen a few movies yourself, obviously, over the past couple of weeks. Now that some of the holiday movies are starting to come out, the holiday season gets a little earlier, I suppose, every year, huh?
Well, it's a lot of pressure on films to get into the theaters because even though Oscar nominations will be important to movies coming out, there's still that first couple of weeks that the box office has. In some ways, Hollywood does itself a disservice by putting so much pressure on movies to open big and then stay big, but that's the business these days.
It seems, I mean, even with the most hyped movies, it's 1 or 2 weeks, and then what was that movie?
Well, that's right. And, well, the business is good, so there are a lot of movies opening. There's basically, from the summer through Christmas, 2 or 3 a week. And most people don't get to see a movie 2 or 3 times a week. So it's a big crunch, but that's the way it has to be. But what's also interesting is if one of those movies that opens in any weekend is really a big hit, it actually drives the box office so that other movies playing can benefit from some other movie being hit. So it's an interesting, in some ways they know what they're doing, but in some ways they cut each other's throats.
So people will take that extra time, extra visit to the movie theater. They may see a trailer that they like or, see a poster in the theater or something like that.
That's right. And I also think there's a kind of excitement. It just generates, this is a big movie. And somehow accrues to the benefit of movies when there's a big movie. Now, it doesn't always work. I mean, some movies will just be for a certain audience and they'll see that and they won't see something else. But for the most part, a hit drives everyone to see lots of movies.
So is there one big, oh my gosh, got to see it movie this season, or are they going to be spread out over a couple weeks? What's got the most buzz, I guess?
That's a very good question, and I'm not actually sure what has the most buzz. Certainly, the Golden Compass wants to have a lot of buzz, but it doesn't seem to quite be generating that buzz. The controversy surrounding it may help, may hurt, or people may be left cold.
And as a background, this is a fantasy.
This is a sort of children's trilogy, the His Dark Materials trilogy, and the author, British author Philip Pullman, had said that he wrote it as kind of the anti-Chronicles of Narnia, and people took him at his word, and so there's been already a kind of backwash from his statements of years ago. A lot of people, it's an interesting phenomenon. People sometimes criticize a film that they haven't yet seen, and that's definitely been the case.
Well, in this case, though, there is a novel.
So, but you can be sure that the film will make changes from the novel.
Right.
I mean, they always do. And so I think you should give the film a chance to speak for itself. But that doesn't seem to be. So it's hard to say what the big Christmas movie is going to be in terms of the prestige movie. Some of the commercial films, I would say the biggest buzz as a kind of box office hit potential box office hit is probably I Am Legend.
Mm-hmm. That's the Will Smith.
That's the Will Smith based on the Richard Matheson's classic oft-filmed novel, I Am Legend.
How many times has that been
done? It's been filmed twice before, but people fondly remember Charlton Heston's The Omega Man. People don't really remember the Vincent Price version from the 1950s.
I'm sure that had a huge budget.
I'm sure it did.
Being a Vincent Price vehicle in the 50s.
Yeah. I suspect I Am Legend will be a very big hit, but I don't think this will quite be the Will Smith of the Oscar buzz, but it'll definitely be a very big hit. So that's buzzworthy. But probably not Oscar-worthy.
Now, that's a big reason why a lot of these movies are coming out this holiday season. Obviously, people have some free time. They're going to see the movies. But from the studio's perspective, this is the time that they think they can sell the Oscar judges on a Best Picture, a Best Actor, and what have you.
Oh, yes. It's really been for the last 20 years to position yourself to say, I am an Oscar film. Is a fall or winter release.
Why is that? I mean, do they really think that Oscar judges don't have enough memory to say that a film released back in the spring or the summer is Oscar worthy?
Well, I think there's a kind of maybe.
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of like circular. That someone realized maybe 20 years ago that Oscar movies were that movies being released in fall and winter were getting more Oscar nominations. So then they decided to release those kinds of movies. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if you really want an Oscar, you sort of have to position yourself saying, look, I'm releasing this now because I think it's an Oscar film. If I'm dumping it in February or I'm, you know, hoping that maybe an April release people may remember. But the strategy is I need to release it now to proclaim Oscar. So despite the fact that Academy members get free DVDs of all the movies, despite the fact that they, you know, can always go see movies for free mm-hmm. in the theaters, there is that sense that they have short memories and so it's a kind of self-perpetuating strategy. Occasionally a movie that shows up in August or September may get some Oscars.
So the deadline is December 31st. Has to be released by then?
Technically, I believe it has to be released a little bit before that.
Uh-huh.
It was my understanding that they had to play a week commercially in New York and Los Angeles. I'm not positive that that's the same rule, but basically, it used to be, it had to be released before, the year is out for at least a week in L.A. and New York.
Do the studios shoot for any type, any genre of film that might do better in a holiday season than during the summer?
Well, in the summer, they just think about the big budget semi-escapist, the escapist entertainment, and so that's fairly clear. For the Oscars, there's different routes that they can go. In the last few years, I think one of the most interesting phenomenon has been the return, so to speak, of the big budget musical. So that when Chicago was both a huge hit and an Oscar winner, that inspired studios. And so each year now for the past couple of years, you're seeing these big budget, they're adaptations, of course, of Broadway shows, but they come with a certain prestige attached. Now, I don't think Sweeney Todd is going to be an Oscar film, frankly, though maybe Johnny Depp, you never know.
But there's always box office.
But there is, I don't even think it'll do that well, but I'm sure they're hoping, but that's just my prediction. But that's an example of that kind of thing. But otherwise, it's your literary adaptations and serious dramas that tend to get the Oscar type things. And occasionally a big comedy, but it's more rare.
Your calls on the movies are welcome, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to a call right now on line 4 in Mattoon. Good morning. Line 4, good morning. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
This is probably a little bit off what you've been talking about so far, but this past weekend I saw Enchanted, and what a wonderful movie. I had expected to be sort of cutesy and sort of, something just very passable, but I was enchanted with it. They took classic Disney with good tongue-in-cheek and excellent acting, and I just thought it was wonderful, and I know it will not do as well as it should because it is very creative and off the beaten path.
Well, I'm looking over your shoulder, David, and it's the number one box office.
Yeah, I don't know what you mean as well as it should, but so far it's grossed $50 million.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, so I think that people are discovering what you are. Now, what's been interesting about that, I haven't had a chance to see it yet, but when I did see the trailer, I really thought it had potential. I liked the casting. It looked a little bit offbeat to have Amy Adams and Patrick Dempsey. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I love the premise of her coming to the modern day New York in the real world. So that seemed to me a wonderful premise. And so it's certainly, but I think people are discovering it, as you say, because, you know, it seems to be doing well. I don't think it'll do $300 million, but it's obviously a hit.
Oh, I'm really happy to hear that because I had to see it because it was the first creative thing I've seen all year. That wasn't a remake. I mean, there seemed to be imagination, and Disney finally has gone back to producing excellent quality. And what a wonderful, I'm in my 50s, so I was brought up with classic Disney, and it was a really nice match. The animation was excellent, the acting absolutely superb, and the storyline was very, very well done.
Yeah, no, I think people are discovering that, and it might be a good time. Some of the serious movies that are out now are so serious mm-hmm. that, and of course, there is always the question of family movies. I presume it was a PG.
Right.
And so there's always, looking for a place. It's an interesting strategy. You know, it probably wouldn't have done well in the summer, and I think Disney was smart to do it now because it found a nice little slot.
Okay, well, I just wanted to let you know that it's wonderful. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Well,
thanks for your call. You know, Disney's taken quite a few lumps in the past few years. People have questioned the quality, I guess. What's your take on how Disney is doing? Because everybody has a soft spot for Disney. If there's one studio people think about as having a specific brand of type of movie, it's Disney.
Well, you know, they lost some of their steam, I think, with the computer animation.
Right.
And so when DreamWorks, which, you know, now they've acquired everything,
mm-hmm.
but they lost some of their steam there. And over the years, Disney has its ups and downs, but certainly no one can question, you know, Disney's greatness from, say, 1937 through the early 60s. But after that, they did have their ups and downs. But they did make, you know, plenty of money with a little franchise called Pirates of the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
So you could question the creativity, but not the marketing.
But this, as we hear from one caller, this movie is gonna, may help recover a little of that, you know, some of the critical lumps that they've taken.
No, I think it's great. I mean, I haven't seen the film, but I thought the premise was charming.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's been a lot of movies like that, interestingly, though, these kinds of literally or figuratively fairy tales, the Princess Diaries and things like that. So there's an interesting kind of cycle that's coming under the radar that critics might want to pay a little bit more attention to. Movies for girls, for families, for women, that the occasional guy like myself can enjoy as well.
Is this Disney's big entry for this season, or do they have anything else in the pipe?
I don't really know for sure who the studios are. I don't think that they have any. They don't tend to be outside of animation, they don't tend to be the prestige pictures.
Right.
And so with Pirates, they certainly had their summer. And this may be, but I don't think that they have any of the Oscar-type films.
Let's go to another call on line one in Urbana. Good morning.
Hi. I went to see Enchanted 2 with a friend who was in town, and we decided we just weren't up for something heavy. and I thought it was interesting seeing references to King Kong and there were thrills and chills and lots of twists on the classic Disney fairy tale sort of deal, which I found thoroughly enjoyable once I relaxed and got into the movie.
Hmm.
But I also wanted to highly recommend, though it's not in theaters at the moment, you probably need to get it on DVD, and it's not a fun thing to watch. I found it really uncomfortable to watch. But I recommended it to lots of friends, and I said, go see this. This is a must-see movie, and that is No End in Sight. It's Bush and military insiders talking about the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
And their on-the-ground feelings and learnings about it. And we all there were things that I was not aware of, or not aware of the implications of, and I think it's got, you can't, it's a political film, but you can't, folks who are conservatives can't say that it's a liberal film, or made by liberals, liberal speaking. So I really, when people are up for that sort of movie, it's something I really recommend anybody who is a citizen of this country, given what we are doing in the world, needs to see it.
All right, well, thanks for your call.
Yeah, we're in a kind of mini golden age of documentaries at the moment.
I was going to ask.
It's really been
this
fantastic. And that, you know, what I was thinking about the season's films, and I realized that the documentaries about the Iraq War and the Middle East and things like that have just been tremendous and in their own way quite successful and critically acclaimed. What's not been the case, on the other hand, has been the fiction films. They released a number of prestigious films in the last 6 weeks about Iraq or Afghanistan and things like that, and they've just been gone over not at all.
Are there documentaries that we expect to see over the holiday season that might cause some waves?
I'm not aware of any documentaries. I think, except for Michael Moore, they tend to shy away from this season when it's so crowded.
They wait for spring, wait, fall.
Well, they came out in the fall, and occasionally you'll see a counter programming in the summer, like more Sicko. Documentaries.
Inconvenient Truth came out. What time of year? I can't remember.
Inconvenient Truth, I think, came out a year ago.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Sometimes.
Yeah, no, the fall is a good time for documentaries, especially September and October.
Then we go to the escapism.
And then, the semi-escapism.
Right.
As I say, one of the things that studios try to do is counter-programming. With all the serious Christmas films, there's the occasional not very serious film, a film that you might think should come out in the summer. Or in the spring, might show up at Christmas. And so there's a couple of those this year.
And we'll talk about those. Let's go to the phone again. Cell phone in Bloomington. Good morning.
Hello. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Talk to you. Fine. Thank you. I recently went and saw Into the Wild, which doesn't fall into the documentary genre, probably the literary adaptation. Could you say a few words about that? Could you also say a few words about No Country for Old Men? I recently read an Alec Baldwin op-ed piece which said that No Country for Old Men, I think, is a Cohen film,
right,
and that it's representative of Bush's, to speak to the earlier caller, of Bush's involvement in Iraq. And if you would, could you say a few words about Guillermo del Toro and, shame on me, Pan's Labyrinth and the Devil's Spine, I think. Devil's Backbone.
Yes.
And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Okay. Into the Wild, I wouldn't say is a literary adaptation. I mean, it's based on a novel, but the novel isn't. But it is a kind of semi, I mean, you might call it a docudrama, I suppose. I mean,
it's based on a real story.
It's based on a real story. And critically, it was very nicely done. And Sean Penn is an underrated director who probably gets little less respect than he might because he's so politically forthcoming. Mm-hmm. I think there's a kind of backlash against actors who take political stands, especially sometimes if they're very forthright and not necessarily circumspect. But Sean Penn is actually a very talented director. But I think the film, you know, it's the kind of film that's never going to be a big hit. It's certainly very well done. The reviews were very strong, and it's an interesting film. It's obviously
still out there now, or
it's probably at one or two screens, at one or two shows, but it's going to get pushed off. If it's anywhere, it's definitely going to get pushed off in
so
the next couple of weeks.
See it this week if you need.
So
to.
if you want to see that. Now, No Country for Old Men.
Right. That's something that I mentioned beforehand.
It's definitely, yes.
As a Coen Brothers fan.
Yes. Well, as a Coen Brothers fan, of course, you go see everything that they do.
Of course.
But this film, I think, puts them back on track. They had gotten, I mean, we like them, those that do, which is myself included. We like them because they're quirky. And No Country for Old Men is not so much quirky, but it is kind of odd in a way. I mean, it's a weird story with this weird villain character. But I think they treat it fairly seriously, lacking the quirks of some of their other films.
So it's not another Fargo.
Well, Fargo, I think, was quirky in a way that people liked. I mean, that was like the biggest shock for an Oscar, I think, ever. but, you know, some of their subsequent films just haven't done either as commercially or as critically that well. Now, No Country for Old Men is not a smash hit, by the way. I mean, it's one of those films that critics really, really love. Mm-hmm. But audiences, it may not be a mainstream picture. It may not be a mainstream picture at all. I mean, it's quite violent. It's quite stylish, which sometimes can put people off. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely a very successful adaptation of a very important novel.
Is this another movie where the studio's thinking Oscar material possibly?
I think they're thinking Oscar material, certainly. Mm-hmm. I would say Javier Bardem. Probably adapted screenplay and probably Cohn's directing. I'd be real surprised if it wins, but I think it may be a weak Oscar year. It depends on some of the other films coming out. But there's nothing that really has the kind of Oscar buzz that says, you know, put your money on this and don't even bother, you know, voting for anything else.
Or maybe the studio's thinking it could enough interest, you know, after the first of the year that it might get a sort of a review. You know, people who didn't get to see it the first time.
Yeah,
go back
I think that'll help. I think that'll help its box office, and I do think they're kind of counting on it. Mm-hmm. Now, for Guillermo del Toro, mm-hmm. and Pan's Labyrinth was certainly one of the most interesting films of the last five or so years, and Devil's Backbone. I mean, these are very interesting films, partly because, A, he's a wonderful director with a great vision, but also his serious films, as opposed to his, you know, kind of Hollywood films, are really grounded in Spain, mm-hmm. in Spanish history, it's the Spanish Civil War, as a kind of cultural trauma. So I think it's very interesting to have a director like that who can move back and forth between Hollywood and, say, his own culture, and make such interesting movies that people also want to see. I mean, normally you think of Pan's Labyrinth, oh, it's an art movie, and it's got subtitles, and it's, you know, weird, and it's about the Spanish Civil War, you know, so it'll be very, very specialized. But Pan's Labyrinth broke out of that, and I think it's a tribute to him that the Mexican-Spanish, you know, nexus of the Spanish-speaking Mexican directors that are doing
amazing.
So well.
What kind of movie tradition is continuing out of Spain?
Out of Spain, out of Mexico. Well, the greatest thing to me is Mexico, mm-hmm. because the Mexico has had a long, long film tradition, but it's never been able to break through. You have the occasional film like Water for Chocolate, uh-huh. But to see this group of directors, out of Mexico, and they're all friends, and you know, working in Mexican history, Mexican contemporary reality. I mean, I think Amores Perros has to be one of my favorite films of recent years. And so this trio of Mexican, you know, Spanish directors are just it's just incredible to see them grounded and yet making a, you know, crossing over.
We're talking the holiday movie season and the movie industry in general with Professor David Desser from the University of Illinois Cinema Studies Department. Your calls are welcome still, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, 1-800-222-9455. Let's take a call now in Terre Haute. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just saw No Country for Old Men. I just have two questions. Number one, did you feel that there were a lot of holds in it, unexplained kinds of happenings, number one? And number two, did you feel that the villain in it was comparable to Hannibal Lecter?
Yeah, in answer to your second question, yes.
Yeah.
For sure. There's two things about the holes. One is, of course, there's always backstory and things that get left out in any transference from novel to film. But also, I think that the Coen brothers deliberately wish to leave a lot of things kind of not so much open, but mysterious. And thinking that the audiences for a film like this, it's just not a kind of classic film where everything plot point follows one upon the other.
Yeah, we argued about it for a long time after we got out of.
Oh yeah.
Who got what? who did what.
So it's not necessarily incongruous things, but things you just want the answer to, and you're not going to get it through the movie.
No. Yeah.
No, that's right. And I think that the novel's like that, too. So it's a strange way of making movies, but this kind of unexplained or, what we might call plot holes, the technical term might be ellipses, is just the kind of style that the Coens do a lot. But in this case, I think the mood, it's like a mood piece, right? There's very little dialogue. Someone pointed out to Josh Brolin probably doesn't say any more than about 10 lines of dialogue, right?
Did an Academy Award performance in that?
Probably not him. I think Javier Bardem has a shot.
Bardem, yes.
Yeah, he has a shot. Josh Brolin, though, people have admired him, and doesn't probably have much of a chance. But
maybe of course, supporting actor?
Well, no. I mean, also, it's a kind of thing where who's the lead?
Yeah.
Who's the lead in this film? All right, Tommy Lee Jones. I mean, the story is about Brolin. But we'll have to see.
So Tommy Lee Jones' face was enough to get him the Academy Award.
Well, he's very well respected. He has a couple of films this year that people have admired, because he's also in one of those Iraq films that I mentioned earlier. They didn't mention the title, but The Valley of Elah, definitely he was singled out. So that I think he has a shot for that. I don't think the film itself doesn't have much of a chance. But I'm pretty sure No Country for Old Men is going to get some serious Oscar nominations, and people like it, and critics love it, so it has a real chance. The only thing that might keep it back is it's very violent.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking my call.
And thanks for your call. And that draws up something that I was reading, the New York Times Guide to the Holiday Movies, and they find a theme that this seems to be a really violent, bloody kind of Christmas season, more or less. Anything that you make of that?
Well, I don't like to read too much into anything, but
I mean, even the musical is bloody this year.
The musical is bloody this year is a good point. Well, people do think that as we are a country at war, violence and terrorism do surround us, so to speak, on all sides. And sometimes that kind of mood, you need a historical perspective. But certainly in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a very violent turn in American cinema. And people attributed that to the Vietnam era. And so now we're in the Iraq War era, and it's been quite a few years now. I mean, it takes a while for things to sort of sink in, right? And movies take a couple of years to get made. But American movies, have always been fairly violent. It's just that we often don't associate very serious movies, Oscar-type movies, with a lot of violence.
I mean, although last year's Oscar winner was one of the most violent movies I've seen, The Departed.
Yes, I agree, and I think that partly had to do with, again, a fairly weak year, but also Martin Scorsese's overdue acclaim. But also it was quite a good film, and I think that's what's interesting is you can violence has been made somewhat respectable. I mean, probably it goes back to Clint Eastwood's, Unforgiven, and the way in which some of these longtime actor directors, working previously in genre, have made these things serious. I think you're right.
Is there another argument, though, and I've heard this over time, that it seems that in good, maybe it's more good economic times than anything, wars notwithstanding, that people will have more of a stomach for dramatic movies, for more gritty, down-to-earth kinds of movies, whereas when times are tougher, it's the escapism, it's the fantasy, it's the comedy, all that.
There's an argument to be made for that. It's just that Hollywood releases now 350 films a year, and so, you can always find a couple of movies that go against the grain.
Right.
As I say, sometimes it takes years. Movies that are in, people have been trying to get movies made for years and years. I mean, you could say what you want about The Golden Compass, but you wouldn't want to say that it's been, it's just coming out now. I mean, they've been trying to make, movies like that for, sometimes for a decade.
Right.
So, I mean, look at Sweeney Todd. Sweeney Todd is very bloody and very violent, but it's an old show. It may be more weird and even bloodier in Tim Burton's hands, but it's an old show.
I can't wait to see it. So, yeah. It's a Tim Burton vehicle.
Yeah. It's just well, it doesn't, from the trailer, which I just watched today, it doesn't look quite as weird as it might, considering it is Tim Burton, although maybe the trailer unweirds it. But in any case, it's hard to make large claims for something that, you know, things take a long time to get made, and, you know, sometimes it's coincidence. On the other hand, Hollywood is a small town, and when you know that a certain script, everyone knows what scripts are being bought. Everyone knows what scripts are in production, and so you can ride the coattails of movies even before they come out. Mm-hmm. And so that's another thing. So I hate to make too many broad claims about you know, what it means, but certainly Iraq has been going on for so long that I do think the national mood must be infected by that.
Right. Once again, your calls are welcome for David Desser, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phones again. A caller in Champaign. Good morning.
Hi. This is an old movie that I'm going to mention, but it was suggested by my brother-in-law, and my wife and I ordered it through Netflix. And it's been around for some time, but I'd never heard of it. And it was probably one of the most delightful movies I'd ever seen in my life, and it was Secondhand Lions with Robert Duvall, and I think,
Well, it's not so old.
Yeah,
so only a couple
and
years
it was
ago.
It was one of those movies that wasn't very profound, but it was just absolutely pure fun, and it's one of the pure fun movies that I want to see again and again.
Wow.
Let's review, because I remember the title, I don't remember the premise.
It was two uncles. And they have dumped on them their grandnephew, and this kid is dumped there by his mother, who is going off and doing her thing. And these two uncles tell these yarns about what they did in their life in northern Africa. And it's just absolutely wild, and it turns out at the end that, you know, you think they're just making this stuff up. But it turns out in the end it's all true. And it was just absolutely fun.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that.
It was a real sleeper. I don't know why it never got the publicity that it really deserved.
I recall, I don't read that many reviews, but I'm going to say that the reviews were negative. And that it just, you know, maybe the title didn't inspire people, you know.
Well, the one review that we found said that that if you can stick with it with all its flaws, it really is worthwhile. That's the way the review read.
Yeah,
and it was a 3-star review. But I just thought it was absolutely delightful, and so did my wife.
First of all, that's one good thing among many about DVDs. You can always catch up to these things.
Right.
But it's also the sad thing about, you know, a movie that just gets crushed in the first couple of weeks. It's hard for people. You know, it's the strategy of a movie like that may or may not deserve to play longer, but it's the old word of mouth. And it's very hard for a movie to stay in theaters by word of mouth. And that's the biggest change in Hollywood's distribution and theater and theatrical distribution is the ability to keep a movie around so that maybe by its third or fourth week, it actually is doing better than it did on its opening week. And that's really become a thing of the past and in a hurry. And you can point to a lot of movies in the old days that, you know, didn't open very well, and it took a while for, I mean, the great example is My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yes.
Where if that was just, you know, for its first couple of weeks, it's nothing.
Yeah.
But it hung around, word of mouth. So Secondhand Lions, you especially now, you've seen it. I haven't have to give word of mouth for that one on DVD.
Right.
All right.
But thanks for the recommendation.
And thanks for your call.
Yeah, I really love Robert Duvall, by the way. I mean, he's always good, so there's always something to recommend a Robert Duvall film.
Let's go to line 4 in Terre Haute. Good morning.
Good morning. I missed part of the program, so perhaps you've discussed Gone Baby Gone. I was wondering what your take on it was.
Oh, now, you see, that's very interesting, because that is a very, very good film, and it just didn't find its audience. And it won't. And that's one of those things that's very puzzling to me.
And which film is this?
Well, this is Ben Affleck's directorial debut, and it's based on a Dennis Lehane, is that his name, novel?
Yes.
Same as Mystic River. Mm-hmm. That same gritty kind of Boston setting. And Mystic River, of course, did extremely well. In every respect, Oscars and commercial and critical. And Gone Baby Gone was very well respected. It's just the audiences just didn't find it.
I think there's one reading of that film that I have not picked up on in anybody's analysis. And that is, of course, Ben Affleck is quite outspoken on the Iraq War. He's quite political. And there is a reading of this film that can almost be seen as an Iraq statement. The rushing in to kill the bad guy, and then the remorse about it, the saving of the lost child by the Colin Powell-like character played by Morgan Freeman, the Jack Doyle character, lost Vietnam, and he's not going to lose this child.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a strong element there that seems to be completely flying over everyone's head, whether it was intended or not. It seems to come out of Ben Affleck, the strong anti-Iraq activist.
Interesting.
I also wonder if people decided to pass over the film just because they think, oh, Ben Affleck, he's the guy who did Jersey Girl.
Yeah, I think Ben Affleck's critical, his image in the public is so beaten that when he returned, I mean, he was loved, he was beloved. And you always think about how much people love Matt Damon and dislike Ben Affleck. I'm not sure that Ben Affleck's anti-Iraq war stance is what hurts him. I think what hurts him is that overly public persona and all that Bennifer business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just, you know, he's one of those people who's you know, got caught up in the gossip so much that he can't be taken seriously any longer. And it also may be kind of overkill, even though, you know, Gone Baby Gone has nothing to do with, you know, Gigli and Jersey Girl or anything like that, that the ill will that may have nothing to do, I think, with Iraq still translates. Although it's a very serious film, and it's kind of it never would have been a big hit. You know, it never was going to be a blockbuster, but certainly it deserved a little more attention than it got from audiences. I have to say that.
The critics just went overboard on the setting. Like, every large city doesn't have denizens of the deep that hang out in these grungy bars. It's like, you know, only South Boston has an underclass. Every major city, including probably Champaign Urbana, has an underclass that you can play up. But that's all they seem to concentrate on. It was really sort of cut the meanings of the movie off at the knees.
Well, a lot of the reviews that I read were complimentary to Ben Affleck and extremely complimentary to Casey Affleck. It's just sometimes it's funny. Well, I also don't think that reviewers necessarily help make or break a film any longer.
Huh.
Unless the reviews are unbelievably amazing.
Well, they have to be unbelievably amazing, but many movies are review-proof. Mm-hmm. Second of all, because so many movies need that first weekend that reviews don't have a chance to sink in, people have already made up their mind what they're going to see before the reviews. Also, I think reviewers are the importance of reviews get dissipated because everybody is a critic on the internet. I mean, there's so many blogs and so many opinions that, but, you know, it's still up to audiences to get out to go to theaters and Gone Baby Gone. And, of course, it also was released at a time of the year when people are kind of between movie going. It's that after Labor Day, before mid-October kind of thing that happens. You know, it's just people say, well, I'm not in the mood to go to the movies. I went to the movies all summer, and I will go to the movies again in November and December. And that could have hurt Gone Baby Gone, because it had a decent release pattern. It wasn't one of these things that only showed up in, you know, 15, 20 theaters.
People choosing what movies to see when they arrive at the multiplex, I'm amazed how the theaters are bereft of any information
Oh, yes.
Available on the movies when you go in. Besides,
they figure you made your choice already, huh?
People go up, and I've been in line, and people go up to get a ticket, and they'll ask the person giving out the tickets, you know, about the movie, of course, most of them, about the movies.
They won't know, right?
16 there, they won't know anything.
No. No, you know, years ago, I'm thinking maybe 20 years ago, I went to see a film at a big theater in Manhattan that had, I think, only two other screens. And the movie that the people in front of me wanted to see was sold out. And they looked around to see what else there was around that time. And I realized the brilliance of the multiplex. And one of the reasons that multiplexes have gotten even bigger is that you can go to the movie theater any time of the day, and there'll be something starting within 15, 20 minutes. And if if I go to the movies at 1 o'clock and I say, what's up next? I'm likely to see something.
It's a spin of the wheel, but sometimes it works.
But at least you'll see something. So,
How far is that from the golden age of the 30s and the 40s, where people went to any movie?
They went to the movies, right?
Times a week.
That's right. They went to the movies. In fact, I tell my students, they look at me like I'm insane. Not only did you just go to the movies regardless, but you went into the movie whenever you got there.
Exactly.
Even if it had already started.
Right.
And what you did was you sat through it until the point you came in, and then you left. And that is a whole different way of, you know, going to the movies, and, you know, it starts in 10 minutes, and I'm going to sit quietly and watch the movie. Here's like, oh, this is where we came in, let's go. But those days are long gone.
And you caught the newsreel and the cereal and all that stuff
between. Oh, yeah. It was always a double feature. Right. But it was your neighborhood. You just went to the movies. Mm-hmm. Now you don't. Now you just go to the multiplex. And what I also impressed about multiplexes, by the way, is how when multiplexes first started up in the 60s and 70s, the theaters were always very bad. Anyone over 40 can remember these really terrible theaters. And now mm-hmm. the multiplexes have gotten they got the word of big screens, good sound.
Decent seats.
And now you're going into a new phenomenon of exhibition, which is luxury boxes and catered meals.
And opera.
Opera in the theater, yeah. But you can go to some of the movies. Chicago has one, L.A., especially a chain called the Movie Co., and you get basically a private box and a dinner for $35, $40. And this is a whole different way than, you know, sitting down front and munching loudly on popcorn.
Sure.
But, you know, exhibitors recognizing that audiences at home have widescreen TVs, you know, flat screen TVs, HD. They've got to compete, and they used to compete.
Just can't get the comfort and the presentation together with the quality of the product.
the content, the quality is getting better, but we still need some content, and I could say something about that the content, I think, is deteriorating for a number of reasons, but I see there's another call, so I maybe can save that for another time.
10 minutes left on this one. We'll have to do it for another time.
All right. Thank you.
Well, thanks for your call, and let's get to that one other call before we talk about content and some things that we missed about this particular season. Line one in Urbana, good morning.
Oh, hi. How are you today?
Good.
Very interesting. I've always enjoyed your shows, and I enjoy your thoughts on this. I'm going to talk a little bit about the film Beowulf, mm-hmm. the new digital version that uses contour digital imaging, which is very close to lifelike. I've noticed that the film was rated PG-13, and it has very explicit nudity in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to draw something in that I think is connected to this, maybe unknowingly. About 3 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled on a pornography case that had to do with child. They said it was, the U.S. government said it was child pornography, but the Supreme Court threw the case out saying it was art because the images had been digitized in Photoshop and converted it into, like, paintings.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if this contour imaging, because it's PG-13 yet, it's, you know, I see pretty explicit nudity, if the film industry is going to recognize that case could apply to this, and go into, you know, territory they normally wouldn't go into, and just say, well, you know, the Supreme Court said it's art, so we can do what we want, you know, very explicit sexual material, and not get an NC-17. I'm wondering if there's any tie to that. I don't know if they're smart enough to think that out, but, you know.
That's a very good point. I remember when I saw the trailers
mm-hmm.
For Beowulf that it was unclear to me how much was going to be Angelina Jolie and Ray Winstone and Anthony Hopkins, which is a pretty heavy-duty cast in some ways, and how much was going to be, you know, it's Robert Zemeckis who did Polar Express.
Yeah.
And Polar Express, you know, is clearly leans, say, more toward the what looks like computer-generated imagery.
And contained a guy who looked a lot like Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks, exactly. Yeah. Versus, you know, the kind of motion capture, you know, that Zemeckis, you know, who's done here. But I think that's right. I mean, I think that clearly the PG-13, though, you know, PG-13,
yeah,
is the industry standard. It's the most desirable rating for most blockbusters and would-be blockbuster films. And so they, you know, they'll do anything they can to push the envelope of PG-13 without going over. Now, of course, I have no way of knowing whether the people who saw this, you know, who might have given this film an R, had it been strictly live action, compared to digitizing it and all that, you know, gave it a PG-13. But PG-13 is really, you know, I think 10 years ago, half the movies that are PG-13 now would have been an R.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, so, especially in the violence realm.
In the violence realm, yeah. Absolutely.
But I'm wondering, I'm just wondering this because I know that Supreme Court case pretty well because I've read the brief. And I'm just curious because I'm in the commercial art field and I do a lot of digital imaging, but I'm just curious as to whether they're going to say, well, this form is really cartoon and content is secondary. You know, you were talking about content earlier, and mm-hmm. I agree with you, content is slipped. It's like as if like somehow the writer's strike is sort of like indicative of the fact we can't get our good stuff out there. You just want crap. But, I mean, I don't know. It's just I find you're a very interesting person, and thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thanks for your time.
Can I say something
sure.
about the in Japanese animation, there is something that I thought it was an interesting phenomenon back in the late 80s, early 90s when I discovered Japanese animation, which is that there were things that were clearly adults only. And none of that has ever been released commercially in the U.S., mm-hmm. And it's not so much pornography. I mean, if it were live action, it would be rated R, though it would be, I suppose, the hard R. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it was animated seemed to me very interesting, and that what would be the appeal of animated sex? But it's very, very popular throughout Asia and has, of course, a very big following here.
Right.
And so the notion of if you not just digitize, but if you animate something, does that somehow make it less objectionable than if it's not? And I know the child pornography case as well.
But you're thinking perhaps might the studios be thinking of an end around?
They might.
The
they might be. But what they also have to think is they have to think about a backlash.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason PG-13 came about was that there was a very big backlash at a number of movies that were PG. Parents groups just said this is too much. So you actually had a PG-13 rating that came out 20 years ago. So you do have to be careful about a backlash at some point about that.
Let's get one last call in Urbana. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm thinking about the play Avenue Q, which uses puppets and definitely
yes,
pretty explicit sexual scenes.
Yes. I agree.
Which I'm sure will be in the movies in the
Probably.
Next few years.
Yes, okay.
In some way or another.
Oh, and that will be a very interesting example. It may or may not. I mean, it's hard to say. But yes, you're right about that. I'd forgotten about that. I'd never seen it on Broadway, but I do remember reading.
No ratings on Broadway.
No ratings on Broadway. Although back when Hair came out and its infamous nudity, you did have the question of, is this obscene or not? But that's very interesting about the puppets and Avenue Q.
And on the other hand, when the movie Hair came out, it didn't look very much like the play.
No, but it also came out 11 years after the play, and it seemed when the movie came out in 79, it seemed more quaint than anything else. Mm-hmm. Though I did like it.
Well,
thank you
for your call. Appreciate it. A couple things that I wanted to ask before the show is over. You talked about the writer's strike. When is this going to start affecting motion pictures, or has it already?
It hasn't yet, because they knew the strike was coming, and right. So there's a lot of scripts in production. But if it lasts very long, they'll have to either put movies in production quickly, or there could be some problems.
Are we talking weeks? Are we talking months?
No, it'll have to go on for a few months before you see the problems. I mean, you know, it's the problems. The real problem, of course, is the television series mm-hmm. that are only 4 to 6 weeks ahead. You know, you're talking about they've got enough scripts.
Movies
to
are
make,
a lot, you know, a lot more.
Yeah,
advanced.
You need a lot more lead time, but yeah. You also don't want to crowd your thing. So you know, if you start putting movies into production quickly, you know, years ago I met a very famous director, and his last film is a guy named Don Siegel, and his last film was terrible. And I asked him, I said, "What happened?" He said, "The script. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't ready." So you start putting movies into production quickly to, you know, you want a normal cycle of, you know, every few months the big studio puts a new movie in production. You put a movie into production quickly, you're going to run into problems.
So things might slip a little.
They might, but I think the strike will be settled within a month, but who knows?
and very quickly, in a few seconds, if you can do it, is there one movie that that people will want to really see that may slip under the buzz this year?
I'm going to recommend a counter-programming movie.
Okay,
it's coming out soon, and it's from the pen of Judd Apatow, who's on a hot streak with his films, and this is a comedy about a rock star. John C. Reilly called Walk Hard.
Oh, goodness.
The Dewey Cox Story.
We're starting to see some trailers for
that's
that
right.
On TV.
I think that movie is going to be hilarious. So Judd Apatow, I trust very much. So Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story. No Oscars, probably, but that's my Christmas film.
Okay. I had a whole list of movies that I was going to ask about. maybe if I can get a couple of words about Jack Nicholson's got one called The Bucket List that's coming out.
Yes, I think that'll be good, and that has a chance. But I find it very interesting to make a movie about older people. This is two men who are dying of cancer and getting their last bit. I think that'll be good.
And Charlie Wilson's War with Tom Hanks.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a big disappointment. Tom Hanks, Julia Roberts, serious film done in a comic way, but about the Afghan, the Mujahideen and the Russian Afghanis. I think that's going to be surprisingly poor performance.
Gotta go. Thanks for your time, David. David Desser is a professor of cinema studies at the U of I, and he joins us every now and then to talk about the movies, especially at this time when the holiday movies are coming out. And we thank you for your calls as well.